I'm Duncan McLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast, brought to you today by BBD. I'm in BBD's offices in Johannesburg today to talk to Matthew Barnard, the company's executive head of banking and director for BBD UK, as well as Dieter Roche, executive head of cloud services. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
So we're going to talk today about cloud innovation in the financial services sector, which I know is going to be of great interest to a lot of our listeners. But Matthew, let me start with you with a broad question, if I can. Financial services companies worldwide, including here in South Africa, have always tended to be at the forefront of technology innovation. They're the biggest spenders on IT. There are, of course, several disruptive forces emerging, including cloud computing, that could turn this sector on its head. What are some of the big trends, particularly in software, that you're seeing in banking IT and financial services IT more broadly, that you're seeing right now?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, turning it on the head is accurate. You know, it, I think it's actually being turned on its head already. There's a lot of change happening in industry and a lot around digitization and that. And digitization is actually quite a broad topic. You know, banks have always actually been quite digital, you know, for the last 20 or 30 years. You know, they brought through ATMs, they brought through web banking, you know, many years ago, 10, 15, 20 years ago. You know, so it's a progression from where they've been. But actually, I think it's reached a tipping point where things are actually changing quite significantly at the moment. Many of the banks are feeling like they're being disrupted, and I think they are to a certain extent. And what's really playing in that is it's not necessarily one technology, it's not just cloud, it's not just what people talk about as digitization. It's actually many of these things coming together at the same time. And banks are grappling to say, how do we deal with that? And it's very hard because a bank is a very big, complex ecosystem. It's not a Spotify, it's not an Amazon, which are actually reasonably simple business models. They're doing very complex products, complex processes dealing with financial transactions. So moving and turning those organizations is actually quite a difficult challenge. It's not as easy as a startup. And where I see banks having problems, or any large financial services company having problems, is they're trying to compare themselves to a Spotify or an Amazon and that. And actually, they're far more complex, and the way they're going to deal with things is far more complex than that. So it's not just about technology. It's actually about technology, processes, people, and actually culture as well. Bring all those things together in terms of that.
And regulation, of course.
Along with regulation, yeah. I mean, yeah. You're working in a highly regulated industry, so you bring those together. Banks face far more complex challenges than any other industry, I think, that's being currently disruptive. So the challenges are really, really large. And the answers aren't simple answers in terms of a tech's going to solve it, whether it happens to be cloud or a culture change or we've suddenly gone agile. Doesn't change these organizations easily or quickly. It's actually bringing all those things together. So yeah, the challenges are huge. The disruption is happening.
And sitting still isn't an option, is it? I mean, they're being disrupted. The new competitors coming. They can't sit still and do things as they used to.
That's right. They can't sit still. So you've got the new upstarts, the fintechs of the world that are out there, making a lot of noise, have great marketing, telling everybody how great they are and what they're doing, and how disruptive they are, and that makes the bank executives scratch their heads and go, oh hell, what's coming after us? Are they stealing our market? And I think banks traditionally have had quite a cushy market where they've made good money, they've done well, and there hasn't been a lot of competition. So this new competition is making them rethink how they're seeing the world and how they're seeing the market and their interaction with clients. So it is definitely a challenging time for them. Having said that, though, before, you know, a couple of years ago, it used to be seen as the upstarts and the challengers. It was like they're the competition. You know, we need to, how do we deal with these little guys? Recently, that's changed a lot. Is how do we work with these guys? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I think both have something to offer. You know, the large financial services have scale. They've got clients. They actually have money and capital. The small upstarts and fintech companies often don't have clients. They don't have capital. They're not sure how to run a very large scale business. So those two organizations actually have more synergy in working together than necessarily necessarily competing against each other.
It's a good point you make, because we've seen some big legacy, if I can call them that, financial services institutions investing quite heavily in fintech startups and directing a lot of capital in that sort of direction. And I guess it raises the question about whether if you want to innovate and compete with these new upstarts, these young Turks, if I can call them that, do you do it internally, or do you almost create a separate startup within your own organization to challenge your existing business models?
Yeah, I mean, in South Africa here, we see all of the above. You see them trying to create internal departments to do it, but they often aren't necessarily the right people or the culture to do it. Sometimes they try to create a little bit further outside their organization by creating separate entities that do this, and that sometimes has some success. I don't think there's a one way that works for everybody. I think you really need to look at it on a case-by-case basis. And I think with many upstarts or any entrepreneurial organizations, you know, you probably find 1 in 10 is going to work. And then as a company, you need to know is that we're happy that actually that's actually going to happen. If you look at yourself as a private equity investor, you know that the ratios of startup companies to companies that are being successful are, the ratios are going to be massive. So even in the 1 in 10 that may be successful, it may be only 1 in 100 that's very successful. Are banks willing to have 99 failures? It's not in their DNA usually to accept that. They were looking for 99% success. So I think, you know, each organization needs to decide its strategy of doing that. But I think it's definitely working with the fintechs, so with the startup companies, is actually beneficial for the banks than necessarily seeing them as competition and trying to drive them away or stamp them out. I think if you look what banks spend in terms of their spend, in terms of what they spend on IT digital transformation projects, it's multiple billions every year for each organization. If you look at what you invest in smaller startup companies, I mean, the startup companies would be happy with, you know, sort of 10, 15, 20 million, you know, which is a couple of days' work in a large organization. So those investments aren't really big in the bigger scheme of things.
Well, you're director of BBD UK. How are British financial services institutions approaching this differently, perhaps, to South African companies?
I think it's actually not that different. You know, so I've spent a lot of time over the last, you know, sort of like 4 or 5 years actually really spending a lot of time understanding what's happening in the UK market or even international markets and comparing that with what we're doing in South Africa. I think the thing that's actually surprised me most is actually how well set we are in terms of financial services companies in South Africa when I compare to what I see happening in the UK. So, you know, 10, 15 years ago when we used to be sort of like maybe sort of 2, 3, 4 years behind what was actually going on in the UK. Now I really don't see a lot of difference in our approach to how we're doing things in South Africa to what I see happening in the UK and the rest of Europe. So we're definitely on par there. I think where we're slightly behind is actually probably more on the cloud aspect, where cloud in Europe and the rest of the world is quite mature in terms of local data centers being available and the acceptance that you can use them for large-scale projects and enterprises. Where in South Africa, we don't really have those data centers here within South Africa, so we're probably, you know, I'd maybe say 12 to 18 months behind where they are with that adoption. But from a thinking of how we work with fintechs and how we're being disruptive, I think we're very much in the same place, and we're actually quite well positioned, if not, you know, maybe some places ahead of where they are in the UK.
Well, that's good news. Dieter, let me bring you in here. I want to come back to a broader discussion about how financial services institutions are tackling the cloud as a project. But Dieter, many institutions have enormous legacy technology, and I know Matthew was just talking about the fact that they spend billions every year, and there's a lot of sunk cost in our big banks, for example. Is this legacy technology holding them back in terms of their digital transformation projects? How much of an inhibitor is this legacy technology to them doing real innovation?
Look, like you said, it's a sunk cost for them. So there is definitely the mindset of we've already paid for it, we need to leverage it. Having said that, the biggest problem that we typically see when we help clients migrate, especially large corporates, migrate to the cloud is really in in the process side of things. Mm-hmm. They're used to doing things a certain way. They've got a security team who does things a certain way. They've got a team of DBAs who manage the large enterprise databases a certain way. They prefer massive Oracle databases rather than many small MySQL, Postgres, or some other vendor, you know. And really what we see there, if you look at how things like the cloud, patterns like microservices, and if you look at the startups like Spotify, like Uber, etc., how they do things, they've moved away from these models where you have big centralized models and lots of processes with lots of red tape and bureaucracy, and they basically moved to an environment where you have small teams who own a particular piece of functionality, but they own it cradle to grave. So they own the databases, they own the security, they own the actual application servers, the deployments, and especially for big corporates, they're not set up that way. So firstly, to get people to change is difficult because they feel safe in what they're currently doing. The cloud is a big unknown to them, not because it's unsafe, simply because they're not really accustomed to it.
Makes them feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's fear of the unknown, which is completely understandable. When you're a business, you don't want to take on unnecessary risk. So it's risk management in a sense, but it's primarily because of fear of the unknown. And that is where we see the biggest struggle for corporates in changing from how they've traditionally done things to how they do it now. But it's also where we see the corporates who embrace that and really, from the top down, embrace the fact that there's a new way of doing things. They are also the guys who are able to very quickly adopt this new technology and really sort of outpace their competitors in terms of what their offerings are. And once they realize the benefits the cloud gives you in terms of really experimenting very quickly, very easily, getting new products to market very quickly, very easily, once they realize that, there's really no going back, and that's how they start to outpace the competition.
Yeah, I think that point is the one thing I've seen is the difficulty is, if you think about it, is banks are entities that manage risk. And what they do is they've employed people over the last 100 or 200 years of, we bring certain people into the organization that know how to manage risk. And the personality types of the people they bring into those organizations from the top down are risk management, quite conservative people. Now you're saying is actually, we're going to do this differently. You know, that change, that culture change is very difficult because, you know, your employment, the way you've employed people into the organization the whole time has been no risk, low risk, manage risk.
How do you change that?
I think is the million-dollar question that banks the banks are struggling with. Is, you know, where does that change happen? You know, does it happen from the top down? You know, the CEO of a bank. So if you look at different banks in South Africa, not wanting to name specific banks, some banks have quite dynamic CEOs that actually are reasonably young, quite progressive, understand technology. And those banks have actually changed more rapidly than other banks that have been more conservative. So I think it's a top-down and it's a culture change that from the CEO down needs to happen. And that's really what I think one of the keys is actually that culture change. Once you get that culture in place, then the way you change and the way you can adapt and take the technology on that Dieter was saying and those changes is actually easier to enable. Mm-hmm. You know, while you sit with a centralized organization with centralized IT departments and DBA departments and that change is very, very unlikely to happen.
As a depositor, of course, in a bank, as a customer of the bank, you don't want them to take too many risks. You like them to be innovative and to bring you great new services and smartphone apps and you know, everything like that. But you, at the same time, you want them to take care of your money, so they mustn't take risks that are too large.
Yeah, and I mean, I've heard somebody talk about that before. They saw analogies of saying is, you know, if I'm going to lend money from somebody, it's great. You know, all the risk is on them. You know, but if I'm going to deposit my life savings with somebody, I'm going to be really careful where I put that money. You know, so maybe also we need to think about it slightly differently. If you're lending from an organization, I'm happy to go out and lend from a new startup, you know, as a client. You know, the risk is actually on them. You know, if I'm depositing my life savings, I'm going to be very sure that the organization I'm putting my life savings into is a stable, very well managed risk, you know, risk organization. So it's, you know, it's sort of horses for courses really on those things, but I think there's so many aspects to that that you need to consider. And to me, is when we're talking about transformation, a key part of it always is about change management and that culture within the organization as to how do they accept that change and how can they grow with it. And that's where you come to these decisions is to do we try to do that outside the organization or do we try and transform within the organization. And two main strategies I see within banks are they're doing one or the other, or some of them are trying to do both, is, you know, are we trying to change from the inside out in our digital transformation journey? And that's hard because you're dealing with a legacy and those type of things. That's a long, tough journey that I'm not sure people are able to see it through because it could take 5 or 10 years. Versus, should we just scrap it all and just try to build ourselves a new bank on the outside? You know, in the UK, there's a very good example of banks that have done that. There's new startup banks like, you know, your Monzos or your Atoms or whatever. But there are traditional banks, you know, like your RBSs that have created banks on the outside called Bo, where they've just decided we're not going to transform the core bank, we're actually going to build a new bank on the outside. And those two strategies, you know, people need to decide is, you know, are we going to build a greenfield and build a new bank, or are we going to try to transform and modernize what we already have?
Which tends to be the more successful approach?
I think it depends on the people and the culture. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure there's a one. There's
so it really depends on what your organization looks like. The culture of the organization will actually determine what you decide to do.
I believe so. I mean, I think it's, I must say, I think it's easier to feel you can build a new bank on the outside. And when you see the startup banks in South Africa, it's a lot easier to start with a blank sheet and to build everything from the ground up. You don't have the legacy headache in that. But if you're building a single product, you know, a current account or a simple loan facility, that's not too difficult to do. But the retail banks around the world are complex organizations that offer many, many complex products, you know. So you can't really compare a bank that offers 20 or 30 different complex products and loans and letters of credit and all different complex products that big retail banks and commercial banks have versus a startup that offers a current account and they build it on Amazon and they build it in 6 months and they go, hey, look how cool we are, we can do this. It's a single line product. That's not that difficult to achieve. So there are different problems you have here.
Yeah, look, and I think there's space for both approaches. Banking is actually, you know, when people say banking, a lot of people, unless you work in banking, they don't realize how big and complex the banking environment really is. Mm. Most people tend to think in terms of just personal banking or just plain business banking. But when you start looking at things like international banking and the regulations around that, things like letters of credit, letters of guarantee, all sorts of short, medium, long-term loans versus home loans versus boarding loans. It's actually an enormous ecosystem. And I think there are, much to Matthew's point, I think it earlier point, it comes to risk modeling. I think just having one attitude of we take no risk or low risk doesn't fit the entire ecosystem. There are places where it pays off to take relatively high risk because the losses you can incur are actually quite small for the benefits you get. Mm. And then there are other places where, you know, if you're dealing with people's life savings, I want you to be very careful and very conservative. And there I would probably not want you to throw away everything you've learned over the past 40 years in terms of risk and just take
on
anything. Yeah,
you don't want to fail fast with somebody's loan, life savings.
And speaking more from the grassroots level, which is, you know, we typically help big corporates like banks on their cloud journey. And speaking from dealing with the actual on-the-ground people who do the work and get the work done, what I find is the model that works, whether it's doing it outside the bank or doing it inside the bank, is the one where it really is led from the top down. So either the CEO or the COO really is championing this and really feels very, very passionate about actually building, I think, investor value. Mm. You know, it's easy to do something on the outside as a little side project. It's a lot harder to do something that will be sustainable and build long-term value for both the bank, the investors, and the depositors. And the only way to really do that, if you consider, and this is not unheard of, you know, for something in a bank to take 6 months to go from idea phase to getting into production. If you don't have the buy-in of a big champion like that, you can really roll these rocks out of your way and really get that down so that you're able to deliver something in 4 weeks, 2 months, because someone needs to cut through the red tape that has been building for 40 years. Mm. And if you don't have that champion, it's very, very hard to affect change. So for me, it's not about doing it outside the bank or doing it inside the bank. What I see working is when there's real buy-in from the actual board and from the actual CEO or COO.
And who leads the project? The CIO, I presume, but with the strong support of the rest of management.
Yeah, I think that's sort of like changed at the moment. Is I think, you know, before in these large enterprises, the CIO or the IT department used to be seen as a service department, and I think that's the thinking that's changed. You know, the if you're getting a CEO or a chief operations officer that's actually becoming tech savvy, understanding what needs to be done, I think they're leading that, and so the relationship between business and IT is more of a partnership now than it used to be. As you know, you're seen as a service department that the business is telling you what to do, give us a budget, go away and do it,
and keep now cutting costs all the time.
Yeah. And now it's, you know, seen as a we need to partner in this, because the way banks are is we are basically IT entities, and we actually need to the vision and the thinking of how things can be done differently. The guys coming from the tech side have as much value to add as the people from the business side, and you see things differently. So it's seen as more of a partnership than it is a service department, and that's something that's changed. And I think as part of that culture change and that top down approach, is if you're starting to get that right, I think then you're starting to head in the right direction, starting to make the right decisions.
Dieter, you used the term a bit earlier, microservices. Now, I believe that is one of the options that financial services institutions can look at, and the others being monoliths and hybrids. Can you explain exactly what those are and why they're important?
Sure. So I think let's start with what we these days term a monolith. If you look at IT and big systems and big enterprise systems over the last 30, 40, 50 years, infrastructure was very expensive. So you would buy a server or a database or some sort of asset, and it would typically be a very, very big asset, very expensive, in the order of millions and millions of rands, and these things would run for 5, 10, 20 years. And the way we built our systems was very similar. We basically built our entire system on this one server, and everything was connected, everything in the system was aware of all the other components in the system. So that led to something that we these days call tight coupling, which basically means that all of these things are so tightly integrated that when I change one thing, I run the risk of accidentally affecting something outside of it. So in computer science theory, over the years, we've now learned that tight coupling is generally a bad thing. It's very easy to develop very quickly in the beginning that way. So it's still a good model for small systems. But when you get to big, very complex environments like banking or telecoms, etc., it actually starts becoming a problem, because you make a change on something very minor and you end up breaking a customer-facing website without knowing it. So what we've done over the years is slowly move away to models where we start breaking out this monolith into smaller services. So that led to a pattern that we called service-oriented architecture, which was sort of very big from the early 2000s up to probably about 2010 or so. And while the thinking there was correct or was, you know, came from a good place, we were trying to separate out these things. The way we implemented it was we tended to look at the business itself, and we tended to separate out the components based on business units, really business units. So you would have a system for, let's say, KYC, a service for KYC. You would have a service for deposits. You would have a service for credit card, or let's say savings and credit card. And it sort of worked, but we found that these systems they were very chatty. In order to do one transaction, I had to talk to 10 different systems. The problem with that is if one of those systems is down for a few seconds, you can't finish the transaction. So what we've then realized subsequently the last sort of 5-10 years, and this is what we now call microservices. Now, it's a very contentious term. A lot of people get very up in their arms about it, primarily because it's been done again. It's kind of become a buzzword and a bandwagon that people jump on. You know, it's a silver bullet. We'll just do things in microservices. And basically, really what microservices tries to be is to be SOA done right. In other words, we still want these services, we still want these smaller domains, but we want to think a bit about them in a better fashion. We actually want to separate based on the business process or the business function rather than on the business unit. So I can spend an entire podcast going on about that. These days, basically, the thinking around microservices is you want lots of very small services. And when I say service, typically we talk about something called a bounded context, so a domain. I want a service where if I make a change to one thing, I can affect only that one particular process, that one particular function.
Right.
And I must be able to do it in a way that I don't break anything downstream.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's many ways technically to do that, but the reason that it often gets talked about when you talk about the new implementations or the new architectures and patterns like cloud usage is because microservices allow you to very easily scale your business up and down based on demand. So what I can do is, previously, if you bought a very big server, I paid 20 million rand for it. It's a sunk cost. I've paid 20 million rand for it, whether I use 5% of it or whether I use 50 or 100% of it. So for the first 3, 4, 5 years of that asset's life cycle, I'm actually losing. Mm. And only when I get towards the end do I really use the entire asset. And then I run the risk of not having enough when my load peaks. So what microservices allow you to do, because I break down the business into these smaller little components, I can deploy a small component on a small server. If I need more capacity, I just create a second server, I run that same component on a second server, and they work together.
Mm.
And I can scale up and down like this. Now, what the cloud gives you on top of that is the ability to do this dynamically. At the push of a button, I can scale up or down. So cloud and microservices tend to be quite related because they give you a sort of an added benefit when you use them together. The biggest problem we see is that it tends to be sort of it's about 10 years old, the concept, and we're still sort of figuring out exactly how to do some things in this environment. So it is, as I said, sort of seen as a bit of a buzzword and a silver bullet, but what we typically see is people want to go microservices, but they don't actually quite know what it entails. They don't quite know how to do the service design, how to do the bounded context design. And a lot of it is sort of goes against how we've been doing things for 20 years, the way we break down things, the way we deploy things. Especially in big banks. So when you talk to one of the primary beliefs in microservices is that every service should own its own database. Which means if I've got 50 or 60 services that work together to give my bank process, I have 60 databases. Now, this goes completely against what big corporates have been doing for the last 20 years, mm-hmm. where they buy an enormous Oracle database and everything runs on there. So from an operational perspective, there's a change. From a perception perspective, there's a change. And once you start moving to this process or this architecture where you no longer have one big database, one big server, you now have 50 databases, 50 servers. To do that sort of operational maintenance manually is very, very difficult. So mm-hmm. now you need to be able to script these things. You need to have ways to automate. And again, in traditional IT, that's not really our network switches aren't designed to be scriptable. Our databases aren't designed really to be scriptable. Our servers aren't scriptable because it's a physical server. When you get to the cloud, all of that stuff is actually programmable and scriptable. The term for it is infrastructure as code. So if I want to start up a new server, I literally type a command or I have a script that runs and I can start up 1 or 50 or 30. And the amount of effort from a developer's side is exactly the same, whether it's 1 or 100. So all of these things come together, and just to bring that back now to microservices, the big reason it's a struggle is A, it's very different from what we've done in the past, and B, especially in the big corporates, it kind of goes against the way we've been doing things for 20 years.
Which is centralized control.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting. But it almost sounds like the idea almost seems to be like you create these little sandboxes where you can experiment and innovate quickly and maybe break some things in the process. Am I right in that sort of conclusion? It allows banks or any company, for that matter, to innovate faster than they have in the past, because in the past, these big centralized monolithic IT systems perhaps didn't allow for that sort of innovation.
That's exactly it. And that's one of the big benefits that people don't realize with cloud. You know, a lot of people want to move to cloud and they look purely for a cost saving. Mm. And if you do it wrong, the cloud can be significantly more expensive than on-prem. If you do it right, you should at the very least break even. In every single migration we've done, we've actually seen significant cost savings based purely on the fact that, as I said earlier, I can scale up and down. So, yeah. For example, I can switch off my dev environments at night. I don't pay for them when they're switched off. I can't do that in a traditional environment. I've paid for the server. It might as well run 24/7. Mm-hmm. I can scale my production environment smaller during night when there's low load on it. But during the day, I can scale it up again. So there's big cost benefits there. But the big one that people miss is exactly what you're alluding to now, is actually the lost opportunity cost. Mm. What things like the cloud give you is the ability to very quickly experiment, deploy, fail fast with relatively low risk in terms of your upfront investment. And that is actually the model. If you look at all the big corporates in the world who are multi-billion dollar companies, the Googles, the Amazons, the Spotifys, the Ubers, mm. They very rapidly develop a new feature. They'll test it, and they'll typically test it with a small group of people, friends of the program essentially, and they'll make a go or no-go call. And if it's a no-go, they'll scrap it and they'll try again. If it's a go call, they'll gradually deploy it to other countries mm. or to other continents, etc. Uber is a great example of this. Amazon is a great example of this. If you look at AWS specifically, Amazon Web Services, they are currently probably the biggest cloud provider in the world, and they are definitely the cloud provider who gives the most features. They launched over 4,000 features last year,
wow.
New features. And what they do is they iterate very quickly, they deploy very quickly, and then they gradually roll it out. Mm-hmm. If you compare that to the way traditional companies like Oracle do an update or an upgrade, they'll do Oracle version X. It'll be version X for 6-7 years with minor upgrades.
Yes.
Then the next one comes out. And the problem is guys who iterate this as quickly in that market eventually tend to outpace their competition. Simply, essentially, they get compound interest. Mm. They deploy a feature. They deploy the next feature built on the previous feature. So you're kind of standing on the shoulders of giants with every iteration.
Mm. Matthew, do you think banks are asking the right questions when they look to move to the cloud? Are they making the decision to do this for the right reasons? And are they considering some of the stuff that Dieter's been talking about now?
I think so. I think, you know, you've got some really highly competent people within the banks. They're bringing in some new people out of more innovative industries and that. So yeah. I don't think they're naive to what can actually happen that. So yeah, I think they do understand this. It's just like that old thing around, it's like, where do you start with this elephant? You know, how do you start eating it? It's a complex thing, and exactly where do you start with that, I think, is more of their challenge. You know, they've got a lot of guys in there that know exactly what it is they're doing and what they'd like to do. It's just eating that elephant is the challenge. Mm. You know, when Dieter talks around the microservices, you know, we know in simpler industries, like whether it happens to be movie streaming or music streaming and that, not a very complex domain. You can actually define those domains, you can define those services relatively easily. Mm. When you're dealing with complex financial products, it's far harder to define those boundaries and those domains and that. So the challenge is more complex. So it's a design challenge that they rather sit with than necessarily the pure technology challenges.
Mm.
And also, it's very easy to build from green fields. It's very easy to build a project when you don't have anything currently there.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a lot harder working on a deposit or a savings account system, adding a new feature without breaking what's currently there. So migration of an existing service or an existing value offering is a lot harder. It's easy to create something off scratch, but to not break the existing thing and to do that migration where I move to something like the cloud without interrupting the service requires thinking, and it quite often that's the hardest part actually of moving to a new architecture or a new
That design, I mean, exactly, it is that design. You know, the design is not to it's partly technical, but that design is business, understanding the business domain, understanding how the existing thing works. You know, and like we said, banking products are often highly complex, and having people that really understand those thoroughly, are few and far between. Mm. And that's really where the failure sits, is actually often in the how to define the boundaries of what constitutes a piece of work or a specific service is where the challenge lies. And the technology part of it, actually, once you've got that right, can be relatively easy. And that's where the cloud enables you to do it once you've got that correct. But actually, that starting point is a difficult challenge that most banks face.
You almost have to go through every part of your organization, every process in your organization, and think about it and why that process is there, and do I need to reinvent this process? So this is a sort of project you're not going to rush into, and it requires a lot of careful thought.
Also thinking about it differently, you know, so if you're just automating an existing manual process, that's maybe not the right way to start. It's actually rethinking about how does the client interact with that service and how to develop that for the client. So that's sort of like client-centric thinking about how you're doing it. And that's hard for people if you've actually worked in an organization, you know, this is exactly how we run this company. Because processes are long-running and quite complex, and one process leads into another. You know, so you've maybe got 20 to 30 to, you know, X many steps of a client interacting with a bank on a certain product, and then the statements and the interest and everything else that goes out on that. To try and ring fence those services into specific pieces of functionality is quite a complex thing to do. So that design is a process design along with the sort of domain design and the data design. There's so many elements to that actually make getting it right a complex exercise. The only benefit we've got is being able to do that quickly and iterate on that and accept that you can fail fast and actually improve on it, because there's no way you're going to get that design right up front. There's no way to do the perfect design and implement it. Get intelligent people in the room that understand the business, understand the technology, give it a shot, and then keep iterating on that until you find something that's, you know, that's starting to work, then start to go to market with that.
We touched very briefly earlier in the discussion on regulation and the fact that financial services companies are very heavily regulated relative to other industries. In your view, Matthew, does this inhibit their ability to move as quickly as they might like? And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's both, I think. I think, you know, the regulators are there to protect the consumers.
Yeah.
You know, so as a consumer dealing with a regulated sort of financial services provider, you know that actually they've been vetted, there's certain processes and practices in place and risk management that you're not going to be fleeced for your money. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's there to protect the consumer is the main thing. Does it inhibit the banks or financial services companies from moving quicker? Yeah, it does. Rightly so, yeah. Probably it's probably there for a very good reason. The thing is actually is how do you make those regulations move quickly and stay up with the times? That's really the challenges I think the regulators have. So the regulators need to understand that actually, how do we understand what's happening with technology, what's happening in financial services, and how do we move quickly, and how do we create the right sandboxes to allow new players coming in, that regulation isn't a boundary or an inhibitor for new companies coming in. It's something that new companies can test and practice with and actually get into the financial services industry reasonably easily. I think if you look at in the UK, I think the UK has led it in terms of their financial conduct authority in the UK. They started the concept around creating a sandbox. What they do is they encourage new startup fintechs to come into the sandbox and to actually test their product and their processes in the sandbox to verify is it actually meeting the regulations. and it actually meets two requirements. Is actually A, the regulator learns from it and they can actually improve their processes and regulations, and B, it's an easier startup for a new company coming into a highly regulated industry. And I know that sandbox concept is actually from what the FCA started in the UK between five and eight years ago, has actually spread worldwide. Mm-hmm. So I know in Asia and even in South Africa, they've started the concept of the sandbox and how do we enable companies to come into a regulated environment. And it's a two-way street. The regulators learning from the new startups, so this is how it can be done, and can adapt the regulations and the processes to enable it. So your question was sort of like, you know, is it a good or a bad thing? You know, it's a thing we need to protect the consumers. We need to do it in a way that's done in a constructive way that actually allows banks and small companies to move fast to enable them to meet the consumers' needs quicker and easier than they did before.
And due to our regulators here, I mean, you mentioned the Reserve Bank before we started recording, they're quite forward-thinking, right?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I do think the regulation is a very good thing because, as Matthew says, it protects the consumer. And in the financial industry, our regulators so far seem to be quite forward-thinking. The example I used before we started recording was the Reserve Bank recently, I think about a year ago, gave out a white paper on how they see the cloud and what is allowed in the cloud from a banking perspective specifically. And in order to get to that, what they actually did is they engaged with the large cloud providers in the world. So they engaged with the AWSs and the Microsofts and the Googles and said, help us write this thing. Help us understand where we come from. We want to mitigate risk. But we understand that you are an enabler to giving better value to clients. So how do we write this that we keep it safe, but we still enable banks to leverage the functions? And if you look at that white paper, it's very it's not really limiting. It's very specific about what is the responsibility of the bank, which is basically to protect the data and the money of the investors, of the depositors. But it allows them to use things like the cloud. It allows them to use various capabilities and or services. What we actually find is, so there are regulations, for example, like POPI, which is not banking specific, but that is obviously a big concern for all of the CIOs and CTOs in the country currently. And what we actually find is the regulations tend to be very forward-thinking, but clients are very cautious in their interpretation. So one of the probably the biggest argument we hear from clients about not going to the cloud is we're not allowed to take our data outside of the country. Not a single one of these clients has been able to show me this legislation that says they're not allowed to do it. That is simply how they interpret it.
Yeah.
If you go and speak to the cloud providers, they've never come across anyone in South Africa or any legislation in South Africa. There are specific parts of information that you don't want to do that with, for example. And in Germany, for example, they are very strict. All of your personal information has to remain in Germany. In South Africa, the way the legislation words it, specifically around POPI, for example, is you are not allowed to store this data anywhere where the protection is less or to a lower level than in South Africa. Now, POPI is based on the previous version of the European legislation, which means the European legislation is actually more strict. So if you look at it from that context, essentially your data in Europe is safer than it currently is in South Africa based on a legislative...
GDPR is the European regulation.
And that's essentially POPI 2.0.
But storing your data in the United States where the regulations are less...
It's different, yeah. So storing it within the European regulated areas, so it's in data centres there, it's actually reasonably acceptable. If those data centres are in the States, it's less acceptable.
Exactly.
Acceptable.
So... bottom line is what we find is the legislation is actually not really the inhibitor. What is the inhibitor is, again, simply fear of change and fear of potential risk. No one wants to be the first CIO to lose data in the cloud. But I would almost argue, no matter how good your security team is, Amazon has 5 or 10 times the number of people working on the same security. It's probably safer in their cloud than on your on-prem cloud. Mm. Again, you know, our legislators and our regulators are engaging with the role players. They're really trying to find a way to make this work and not limit the market, not limit the options. The biggest problem is just people are not as educated as they should be around things like the cloud, for example. And I understand that in South Africa at least, it's a relatively new thing. Microsoft launched their first data center here last year.
Yeah.
Amazon is promising their first data center middle next year or end of next year, last half. So I would almost argue you've got less than 18 months to get ready for this. I seriously suggest you start doing the research now, because if you're not ready, I can guarantee you your competitors are, and you are going to get behind.
So we mentioned earlier that the banks are facing greater competition from digital upstarts, banks that don't have legacy, and they're building greenfields projects in effect. But specifically in the African context, the banks are also potentially starting to see a threat emerging from telecommunications operators. They're building out their mobile money services and slowly moving up that value stack. Are telcos a threat to the banks? Should they be perhaps seeing the telcos as potential partners, or how do you see this playing out in the coming years?
Well, I think they're actually dealing with different markets, to be honest.
Okay.
I think the traditional banked market, you know, which is, I think, you know, obviously most of Europe fits into that context. But most developing nations, actually, there's two markets there. There is actually the currently banked market that are probably more high-income individuals that actually require certain products and services and what we traditionally see as banking. That's on one side. But actually, the largest market actually is people that haven't actually had access to financial services before. And those people that haven't had access to financial services before, it's a different market. Mm. And it's not necessarily the market that our current banks have even gone after. They've never actually seen them as potentially as an opportunity. And those clients are actually not looking for the type of banking products that traditionally banks have done.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's actually a new market. So it's not stealing one market from the other. And that market is reasonably simple. Its ability to actually make and receive payments, and make and receive sort of like smaller micro type of payments is actually what that market's looking for. And so therefore, it's a different thing to what our current banks actually offer.
Will the telcos stay there, though, or are they going to move up and start competing with the banks directly?
I don't think the telcos will move up and start competing with the banks. I think they're different businesses, to be honest.
Okay.
I think where the telcos have succeeded is they've managed to get their tentacles into all parts of society, so everybody has a cell phone, and the telcos have a relationship with clients in terms of billing and receiving and paying money. And they do that not by big branches, they've done that via small operators and that are dealing from either a shack or a corner street. So that those tentacles they've got are very fine tentacles into every part of our society. That's where their strength lies. Their strength lies in actually they're actually in touch with the community who are actually trying to spend and receive money. We're trying to obviously make cell phone calls and send messaging. Now, to communicate that to actually transferring money is actually quite a small step. And I think that's where they've got an advantage, is actually they are in touch with the local communities and they've got an infrastructure that allows them to do that, which is very different from a banking branch infrastructure that's very heavyweight and very sort of like even reasonably centralized within a town. You might have one bank branch, whereas a telco might have 30, 40 or 100 operators dealing within different areas of the community. So I see them as actually accessing different markets. There is an overlap because we talk about payments.
Yeah.
But actually in terms of what we see as banking and what we see as the payments that people who haven't traditionally been banked, is to me is different things.
Fair enough. Okay. We're about to wrap up, but I'm gonna ask you to put on your what's the phrase? You look into your crystal ball, I think it's the phrase, and look ahead. I mean, there's huge disruption going through the financial services industry at the moment. What do you think banks are going to look like, say, 5 years out? What is this digital transformation, this move to the cloud? What is it actually going to result in at the end of the day?
I think things are going to change quite a lot. I think the banks, between the banks and the customers, are going to be, I think there's going to be more disintermediation there. Mm-hmm. So I see banks moving to be more of a utility, really. Is they've got a lot of value in their banking license in terms of the ability to process mass transactions and to keep your money safe. And people have the trust and they're able to do that. They aren't necessarily, I don't think, going to be the face to the client. So the client will actually deal with small niche players that are actually able to meet their specific needs, whether I'm a more sophisticated individual that requires certain investment products on that, or I'm a client that just requires some mobile money payments. I think each of those client interactions and that channel to the market will be quite sort of like fragmented. Mm-hmm. And there'll be many players in that market that will, so as a customer, I'll say, I'm going to take a bit of A, a bit of C, and a bit of D, and that's going to make up my banking or my financial services experience. But another customer might just want to use X, Y, and Z. And so that relationship between the bank and the customer is going to be disintermediated by small players. And those small players will add more value to those clients because the clients will be picking exactly what it is they need rather than a pure big sort of fat banking service, which is a lot of which I actually may or may not need. So that's why I see it playing out as banks becoming more utilities and more niche players coming in and being that face to the client.
Dieter, last thoughts from you. How do you see the IT function within banks changing over the coming years as a result of everything that's going on now?
I think you are going to get banks and big corporates who really struggle to accept that they need to change their internal structure. You're going to get banks who still insist on trying to centralize things like infrastructure control, security. And then you're going to get banks who accept and embrace the fact that they need to break their teams into smaller, independent, multi-skilled teams. And I think you're going to find the latter of those two are going to seriously outpace their competition in terms of the number of services that they offer to their clients, the speed at which they offer it, and also their ability to react when they find an issue or a bug or they want to release a new feature. I think the banks who, again, lead from the front, where the CIO, COO, CEO truly believe in this journey, and they enable their current IT staff to actually reskill and to learn the various cloud skills, the various microservices design skills, the new architectures, the new security models, the new costing models. The banks who enable their staff to go on training for this and to change, I think you're going to see massive changes and massive improvements from them in the next 5 years. But I think that's probably the number one thing that we're facing currently in our clients is lack of understanding of what is coming, and it is coming. You can't not be affected by it.
Put your head in the sand and ignore
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So lack of understanding of what is coming, lack of skill, and that, I think, transfers to a bigger problem, which is a lack of skill in IT in general in South Africa. If you look at what is coming and what guys who have cloud certifications, cloud skills, how in demand they are at the moment, I think that's probably the number one. The number one and two stoppers would be lack of skills and then wanting to still do things the way you've been doing it for 20 years from a centralized perspective.
Actually, Matthew, I'm going to give you the last word. BBD, what sort of conversations do you have with the banks? What sort of work are you doing with the banks in this field?
I think a lot of what we've discussed, so it's been helping with transformation from the inside out in terms of how do we take certain legacy systems, how do we get the most out of them, but actually put a digital front end on that allows them to get into the market. Mm-hmm. So we deal a lot with that. The other part is actually working with the same clients and partners in terms of sometimes building greenfield stuff outside of that. And you know, that's also quite interesting and different as well. I think one of the challenges that I think, you know, from a South Africa and from a society thing that I think we all need to take cognizance of is you're sitting in the South African market where you've got 29% odd unemployment. It's a real issue. Mm. And at the same time, from an IT perspective and from a digital transformation perspective, we need to have, and we have a lack of IT skills. And you don't need to have 30 years experience to become a cloud engineer. You just need to have the right opportunity in a couple of years and a couple of courses to get on track and to actually become a very valuable member of society that can contribute to this digital transformation that we're going through. And I think, you know, in South Africa, we sit with those challenges of large unemployment, but actually shortage of IT skills. And I think actually that's a challenge, but it's actually in itself is actually also an opportunity. You know, something from BBD perspective that, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at and working on is how do we get people from previously disadvantaged backgrounds that may not have gone through the traditional education and university routes, but actually how do we fast track them into becoming a really competent and good cloud engineer? And that's possible. Mm. You know, with a general basic education, we can get guys up to speed and create those skills. So to me, that's some of the challenges we face as a company, just working with our clients and actually then trying to bring through the right people within our country to enable to contribute to the digital transformation that's going on.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. I think we could sit here and talk for another 3 hours, but I am conscious of the time. So I think let's wrap it there, gentlemen. Matthew Barnard is Executive Head of Banking at BBD and Director of the company's UK office. And Dieter Roche is BBD's Head of Cloud Services. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to Tech Central today.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.